The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, there are a lot of people right now who thought that they were in the majority. They thought that they were representing Republic. They feel like they lost the election a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, they're feeling more European right now, I think, probably than American. And I'd like to address that. Has the majority turned to the minority in just a single week?
Well, and I think the expectation is now that we move towards sort of a European-style socialism. So what does that mean for the U.S.? You know, certainly when it comes to confiscatory tax policies and redistribution of wealth, these are things that we will see more of over the next 3-4 years. I think that's a given. And it has to do with the difference in political philosophy, something that's difficult to really even discuss reasonably or rationally, because you've got two different sides with radically separate and distinct assumptions.
Well, some would like to redistribute the wealth, and, you know, the others are trying to earn the wealth. But, you know, I'm looking at Greece right now. Okay, Greece has been in the news now for 2 or 3 years. It represents sort of, it's a European project that is failing. But I heard that the Europeans have come up with another agreement to let Greece live just a little bit longer.
Well, they have. The Europeans have reached a new deal on Greece. It's the 47th agreement. And I think this is really helpful, actually, because you look at what's happened in Europe, and what we tried to do in this year's DVD, the first one, dealing with European perils, is say, this is the road we are going down. This has nothing to do with the fiscal cliff. It has to do with a much broader fiscal backdrop. And the reality is we've been living well beyond our means for years, if not decades.
Spending too much money.
Right. And there is an inevitability, given the leadership that we have in Washington, to sort of repeat and repeat exactly what we've seen in Europe. Now, not only do we have sort of this cycle of pain in front of us in terms of a fiscal or economic perspective, but we also have that same cycle of here's a solution, oops, it didn't work. Here's a solution, oops, it didn't work. Here's a solution. And again, this broken record, 47th revolution, if you will, of the turntable. And no, we haven't solved anything yet. We're just entering into that pipeline. It's going to be fun.
Well, and at some point, Margaret Thatcher is right. You do run out of other people's money when you've got a socialist solution.
And what we find in Europe, and this is not just continental Europe, Scotland wants to secede from the UK.
Right.
Catalonia wants to secede from Spain. You've got local interests. You've got party politics at a very, very small level looking and saying, actually, world membership, being a global citizen, this is less important to us right now.
It even may have sounded nice at the time, but, you know, we think we can do this a little bit better. Thank you very much.
Well, and that's the reality when you're knee-deep in clover. It's easy to think about largesse and sharing.
Right.
When all of a sudden you go into some sort of a financial drought, everyone is concerned about feeding their own, and that's what we see in Europe. That's what we will see here in the United States. And certainly at the level of protectionism, we'll see that a lot more over the next several years. We have an administration that's focused on labor. You look at the last few meetings and the focus on dealing with fiscal issues, and the consultation was not with the business community. The consultation was not with both sides of the aisle. The consultation was with labor. Isn't this telling? I think it is telling. And it points to what we have in terms of trade conflict and potentially cross-border conflict. Again, at a financial and economic level over the next 4 years, what we talked about last week in terms of currency wars and an economic battle that's going to be fought is going to be supported by a political philosophy which says we're putting labor back to work here in the United States, and we're taking the lower class and closing the income gap between the lower and the upper class. And again, there's some unintended consequences, which we'll get to experience as well as explore, hopefully ahead of time, on the weekly commentary in months to come.
Well, and there are states in our own union, Dave. I know my wife has said, look, if Texas secedes, we're moving.
I'd have to agree. And Debbie, yes, we're moving with you. Maybe the office. And, you know, we made a long trip back in 1992 from Denver to Durango, moved 13, 14 families down here. Not out of the realm of possibility. Texas, you know, I came back from the Thanksgiving holiday with my fair share of poison ivy because Texas has a lot to offer, some of which is not altogether welcome. But having said that, if they secede, they might not even have an even more compelling case.
Well, you know, all right, I'm going to shift gears here for a second because in the week that we're looking at right now, in the news has been Israel and, of course, everyone surrounding Israel, including what had been their ally for about 30 years, Egypt. Egypt's really changing, isn't it?
Well, it is. And, you know, if you look back over the last 3 years, we've talked about Turkey, we've talked about Egypt, we've talked about background issues, whether it is the Shia or the Sunni differences theologically and culturally, which are informing sort of a power play and a shift in who is in control in the Middle East. Now, the reality is there's still a giant question mark hanging over the Middle East. Who is in control? Egypt was a dominant player, under the Mubarak regime. There was regime change. Obama's boy representing democracy in the Middle East.
In quotations.
Yes. Well, yeah. That's Mr. Morsi. Doesn't seem that he's so keen on democracy after all.
Well,
the consolidation of power has begun again, and that race for who's dominant, who's going to be in control in the Middle East, who's going to be the power player, I think Morsi's saying, we'll throw our hat in the ring.
Let's just look at, it's not just the person in power, it's the treaty that's being upheld. And of course, the Camp David Accords are what gave us this sense of security, at least from the south side, for Israel for all those years. And it looks like that's being jeopardized as well.
With what's happening in the Middle East right now, my compulsion over the weekend was to book tickets. I'd love to be in Israel right now. Yeah, I don't mind that rockets are flying. Just before Thanksgiving, we were in transit to Houston.
Right.
Where we have family, and in the airport, there's the television screens with current news flashes and whatnot. And lo and behold, Mark Regev was there talking about, and he's the official spokesman for Israel.
Right, and you know Mark.
Yeah, well, we had breakfast with him when we were in Jerusalem just about 18 months ago, and I would like to ask him a few questions. There's a number of things that I would like to know, conversations that we could have behind closed doors, to go beyond what we have in the news, because I think there's more of a telling story. And I'd like to know the insecurity or security that Israel feels now with 4 more years of Obama and what that looks like in terms of support or lack thereof. Certainly he had the Jewish vote here in the United States. What is their perception in terms of international politics? Because what's important today is not just what's happening domestically, even though we do care quite a bit about that, too.
Well, and, you know, that's funny, Dave, that you bring that up. But if you actually did get on the plane and go to Israel, you would have missed Black Friday, which really, that was the other thing that probably we're seeing on the screen. You were being told, yes, be thankful on Thursday because everybody's closed. But make sure by midnight Thursday that you go ahead and get on down to Black Friday. You know, were you disappointed with Black Friday or happy with it?
It's fascinating. Crunching the numbers, we were on Bloomberg this week, and we were talking about Amazon and eBay and some of the big retailers who were hoping to benefit from Cyber Monday. And Black Friday sales were down 1.8% from last year. And what's fascinating is that if you include not just the 1.8% decrease in sales figures from last year's Black Friday event, but if you consider population growth and inflation, then the decline in actual sales is even greater than that 1.8% states. Where are we at? Where are we going? We see a huge contrast, a huge divide between consumer sentiment, which we think is fairly misguided at this juncture, and executive sentiment, which is extremely negative. And so there is this disconnect between the man on the street saying, maybe things are getting better, maybe I can put a few more dollars on the credit card, versus the executive who's saying, we know what your spending limits are to begin with, and we know that you're basically front-loading your spending into this discount holiday season, which is going to make the first half of 2013 a nightmare.
Well, and you know, David, it does. It breaks my heart, frankly, when I see the commercials all day long Thursday. You know, if you watch any football, you see the commercials, and it really is encouraging people to go spend. And it's strange to live in a nation where people feel like they're being patriotic and they're doing a good thing. 70% of our GDP is going out and consuming something. We've almost learned that that's our form of productivity.
Well, you know, the contrast from an economic standpoint is that investment spending versus consumption spending has a radically different long-term impact. Investment spending gives you the ability to create something again and again and again and again.
Right.
Whereas consumption spending is a one-off event. Once you've spent what you had, it's gone. That's it. There is this difference in philosophy. Again, you drive investment spending or you drive consumption spending, and we are geared towards consumption spending today. What's interesting is that insiders, particularly retail insiders, are very negative. In the last 3 months, we've seen a radical increase in insider liquidations.
Now, you're talking the CEOs who own shares, people who have to report their sales or purchases of their own company.
Yeah, so if you took the retailer index, RTH, the retailer index, and that's a cross-section of a good 20 companies, there's only about one in the 20 where you actually had buying activity at all to speak of in the retail space, where you had insiders of these companies buying shares. The vast majority are selling at a very rapid pace. You take a company like Amazon. The sheer scale is not there. I'm not saying that there was that many shares sold. Actually, there's not that many shares sold, several hundred thousand shares sold. But in the 12-month period, 68 shares were bought. So several hundred thousand, 68 shares bought. The ratio was about 5, almost 6,000 to 1. The ratio was terrible.
Now,
again, not a ton of shares moving hands either way, so it doesn't really matter.
What about eBay?
That's a little different. eBay, on the hand, you had $20 million in executive purchases. So, you know, some activity there.
Right.
Set against $700 million cashed out by insiders.
Okay, let's repeat this. Okay, $20 million going in, actually buying their shares.
It's about 19.8, but call it 20.
Okay, but $700 million coming out now. How are they feeling about eBay? eBay's supposed to be hot on Black Friday.
Well, if it's hot and getting hotter, they would be betting on tomorrow. The reality is they're betting that today is as good as it gets.
Yeah.
It's really important because this disconnect between consumer sentiment, which says things are getting better, therefore I'm spending, and executive sentiment, which says this is as good as it gets. As far as my personal retirement is concerned and my own personal compensation, I'll take the $700 million today, the bird in the hand versus the two in the bush, because I don't like what I see tomorrow. They look at 2013, 2014, 2015 and see that the issue is not so much the fiscal cliff, but a radical change in the confiscatory nature of government. When you don't solve the issues of regulatory concerns, which executives have today, and tax concerns, which executives have today, they are left on their heels and very cautious. Are they going to go out and spend? No, they're not. Which puts us really in an era which is more akin to the 1940s, a wartime scenario where the economy was dominated by government.
Yeah.
Government dominated the economy more than anything else, and executives who were running your largest companies in the country basically said, we're not spending a dime because it's just a gift to Uncle Sam. It's not going to be productive in the long run, and it certainly doesn't serve our company's purposes. We're on hold for the time being. We may have 3 to 4 years on hold.
Well, and that's very dangerous. You know, when you read about the articles and the commentaries on the redistribution of wealth, you know, what they're saying is, well, we've got a broken down infrastructure. We've got schools and teachers that aren't being paid enough. We need more, more, more. And that's exactly right. An infrastructure does need to be attended to, but we've already spent too much money. And the thing that's amazing is they're talking about redistributing wealth from people who already are paying pretty much the majority of the tax base.
It's important to reflect on this because the current administration does hold the idea that the math of equality is pretty easy. Fairness is defined by leveling the income field and closing the gap between rich and poor through redistribution. And again, one of the assumptions, sort of the operating assumptions, is that the rich or the 1% or the 5% or the 2% or the 10% really aren't doing their fair share.
They're getting away with something.
But I think the numbers tell all. The top 1% of income earners in the United States pay 39.6% of all federal income taxes. 1% pays 39% of the total. If you expand that out a bit and say, well, the top 5%, which includes the lion's share of the upper middle class and middle class, the top 5% pay 61% of all federal income taxes. And then if you expand that out one step further to 10%,
the top 10% earners,
72.7%.
So they're covering 3/4 of the cost already. The top 10%
right,
basically are covering 3/4. All right, now let's take the bottom half, though. Let's are they paying any taxes at all?
The bottom half, in terms of federal income taxes, pay 2.4%. Again, when you start talking about sort of the redistributive language that's been used through the election, now post-election, we're going to raise taxes, what do they hope to accomplish? What do they hope to accomplish? This is where I think there's something that's fairly disingenuous in the mix. We're talking about a private sector today which labors hard, as is the public sector. I'm not saying that they don't all work hard, but in terms of how they're compensated, the average compensation in the private sector, the latest numbers out, average out about $60,000. That's all in compensation. That's retirement packages. That's health care benefits, everything, not just your take-home salary.
The guy or gal who does not work for the government, he's working for himself or for a business, a private business.
$60,000. Now, if you work for the state or local government, you bump up from $60,000 all-in compensation to $80,000 all-in compensation. Again, health care, future pension, the whole ball of wax. You go from $60,000 if you work in the private sector to $80,000 if you work in the state and local public sector. Now, if you work for the federal government, federal employees average an all-in number of $120,000. That's twice the private sector.
$120,000.
What's fascinating is, over the last 4 years, one area where we saw radical growth, an increase in employment numbers, was with federal employees. Now you tell me, the average employee who's sort of working for the government and making twice what he could make, 100% more than what he would make in the private sector.
Right.
How is he inclined to vote? I'm sorry. Does self-interest play at all into politics? Does self-interest play at all into the vote? I hope not. But I think so.
I think you're probably right. You know, and I also would have to say the young right now who are getting their college educations and they're coming out and they're either not getting a job or they get a job that's well beneath what they can actually, you know, utilize from their college education. These people are 22, 23, 24 years old and they're saying, okay, now wait a second. I don't have much of a future. That group, it's that age group actually that primarily voted for the redistribution of wealth philosophy, whether it's the president, whether it's Congress, whether it's, frankly, just things that are on the ballot. There's a mindset right now that we're going to have to get ours from someone else.
The reality is that we've got several generations who don't know what a worldview is, who don't know what they think about anything other than what they've been trained to think, both through public school education and the news media, which serves up for you pre-packaged thinking. It's all there for you. It doesn't require processing. It's just acceptance. Okay.
Right.
We know what we believe. This is what we believe. Why do we believe it? We know what we believe. This is what we believe is the response. Why never enters into the equation. The contrast, Kevin, is this. We have a generation, more than one generation, that hasn't learned how to think and can't contrast one worldview with another. The notion that socialism runs in direct conflict with free markets and the success that we've experienced, the social experiment that we have here in the United States. I'm just going back to maybe the only ads that I appreciated during the election, and they were paid for by the immigrant entrepreneur Peter Petterfee, who started Interactive Brokers. And this is a guy who came to the United States with spare change in his pocket and the shirt on his back and is now worth better than $1 billion, several billion dollars, in fact. You know, what he was pointing out is that coming from Europe and living under communism, what he saw was the application of socialist ideas and this notion of redistribution of wealth. It's not that it makes the poor wealthier and the rich poorer. It makes the rich poorer, but it makes the poor poorer as well.
Sure.
And that's what people who haven't lived through socialism don't understand, that redistribution, it's not just a question of equalization, it's a question of leveling opportunity and eliminating opportunity. As you eliminate one of the things that drives commerce and free enterprise, that being, it is at the heart of the free market system that you can better yourself. The harder you work, the luckier you get. Only it's really not luck. It's that opportunities open to you and there's nothing limiting your advance. The notion that from each according to his ability to each according to his need, the sort of leveling of we all do our part and everyone gets an equal or an adequate benefit from it. Again, what it does is it drives against the grain of what is at the core of our humanity. What drives you to get up in the morning and work?
Well, and David, it reminds me of a trip that I took to Germany not long after the wall fell. And it was from Munich to Dresden, if I recall. And on the east side, that used to be East Germany 5 years before the wall fell down. And then when you look at the west side of the fields that had been plowed, that was the west side. And what was interesting was you got to see the mindset of the people, even after, quote, freedom had been given to both sides. You got to see how it had changed the spirit of the worker. On the east side of the road, which was used to be communist East Germany, the fields were gray and untended to, and they had been plowed, but they weren't even regular furrows. And when you look on the left side, or you looked on the west side, you saw what was West Germany. They had been free the whole time. They had that self-interest in mind, that self-betterment in mind. And even after the wall fell, you could see the difference in work habits. And so it is amazing, Dave. You know, we were joking, unfortunately, it was gallows humor, about people voting for free stuff this time instead of freedom. But actually, free stuff comes with a cost.
Well, and I think when we look at the social experiment of the next 4 years, I'm very excited because there are some lessons that need to be learned culturally. Given that our educational system has not taught, it's now that real life will teach.
Yeah.
And we will learn. And I think this is very helpful for generations who've not appreciated the difference between socialism and free enterprise. We will get to see the socialist experiment play out. Am I happy about that? No. Am I excited about that? No. Are we battening down the hatches, so to say? Well, you could say so.
You're not giving up, Dave. And, you know, the thing is, we have a two-party system right now, and we've gotten so locked into that mindset.
Well, giving up. Giving up.
Yeah.
We will continue to hold Edmund Burke's suggestion that all that is necessary for evil to triumph is that good men do nothing.
Right.
We have the idea of a republic, and the idea of a republic ultimately shapes a tangible reality.
Well, and you have said numerous times, ideas have consequences.
Good so ideas have good consequences.
The idea is not dead.
No, it's not, and you can't kill an idea. You cannot kill an idea. This is one of the reasons why when you look at changes, let's say in communist China, who are the first people to go? It is the thought leaders. When they slaughter 1,000, 10,000, 1,000,000, 10,000,000, 20,000,000, you've got to look at the history of China and see that they don't like intellectuals. Why? Because ideas are upsetting. You know, this is a future issue for China. They graduated last year 7 million people, up from 1.5 million people from college,
right,
just a few years ago. That's all well and good as if they have jobs. But if you have a young intellectual class with nothing but free time on their hands because their job prospects are now limited, now you're dealing with a revolutionary class. And you have what reinforces sort of the cyclical history of China, instability built in, ideas having consequences. We look at the republic, the basis of our country, and say, the idea is not dead.
Right.
So who's giving up the fight? I don't know who's giving up. I'm not. This notion that somehow 4 years of a social experiment gone bad defines our future course, you're going to disrespect the heritage of 200 years and say all that was put together can be undone so quickly? All that is necessary for evil to triumph is that good men do nothing. It will occur. This is like the difference between light and darkness. Darkness cannot exist when light is present. It simply cannot exist. It's not a question of fight or victory or anything else. Light has to be present. You take away light and what happens? Darkness naturally fills the void. I'm willing to stand in the gap. I think our listeners are. I think you are. I think this notion that somehow the world has changed inexorably for the bad. I look at the Mexican election that happened this year, and I think there's several things that we will continue to consider here in the next couple of months relating to Mexico, but it's in this post-election period that it's worth remembering that a relative newcomer to the political world and an awfully young man, mid-40s, won an election with a minority of votes. 51% is not the rule unless you're stuck in a two-party system. The math changes dramatically when you introduce new parties. Now, what's fascinating is you may say, we here in the United States had 16 options on the ballot. We don't have a two-party system. How many of you knew that there were 16 presidential candidates prior to looking at the ballot?
We're told it actually pulls the vote away from the guy that we were told we were supposed to support because he sort of believes sort of what we think we might believe.
There's issues that have to be addressed, media issues relating to media bias. There's campaign finance issues that certainly favor a two-party system. But the bottom line is that change does not require an absolute majority. It never has.
So, David, for those who are defeated after the election, you're saying the death of the Republic, actually, the news of that is premature.
Like Twain said in response to the publishing of his obituary before he was dead, the reports of my death are greatly exaggerated. You know, we look at sort of resignation, a lack of political involvement. You know, this is, I think, where family discussion, social dynamics, a community commitment, what do we want? 2 years from now? What do we want 4 years from now? This does not come down to a dividing line between Republican politics and Democratic politics. We're going to experiment with economic ideals.
Right.
Again, I'm focusing on taxes and a redistribution of wealth. And I'm saying that, frankly, we haven't seen much difference between the Republicans and Democrats. Yes, occasionally there's a few bones thrown in the direction of the Republicans when a Republican is in office. But, hey, Republicans are just as corrupt as Democrats when it comes to taking their portion of pork barrel spending back to their constituents. There is major issues tied to the tax take and the redistribution of current taxes, let alone the issue of future and increased taxation, which have to be addressed. And the question really is, between you and me, between us, as we discuss this with our family members around the Christmas table, as we go into the new year and into the next 4 years, what is the ideal? What is the Republic? Is it dead? No, it's not. How is it not going to be dead? Well, I don't know. It will be dead to the degree that we leave it alone, to the degree that the light is hid. And then again, this is kind of perhaps silly, but when I was 5 or 6, I learned a song in Sunday school. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Hide it under a bushel? No. Granted, this had to do with the gospel and not with politics, and there's a difference. I don't want to conflate the two. But if there is an ideal, the vacuum will be filled if that ideal is not promoted, if that ideal is not discussed, if that ideal is not flushed out, if it's not recognized for the values inherent to it. Do you know what the Republic is? Is this the country that was intended? Is this the political system, a system of redistribution where we eventually run out of other people's money, as Margaret Thatcher has said? Was that what we were intended to be? The snake eating its tail? I think not. And I think to be resigned at this point is to be naive in terms of the totality of what can be done in 4 years.
Well, and actually, Dave, you know, and you've brought this up before, if we were to lose half of the freedoms, or 70% of the freedoms that we have now, maybe even 90% of the freedoms that we have now, we still are more free than most of the other countries that are out there. And so you brought this up before. We need to have perspective and say, okay, yes, we're seeing freedom suffer right now, but we still have elections. We still live in a country that has a number of relative freedoms. And so the tragedy would be that no one get out there and actually express the ideal while it still lives.
Or even appreciate or understand the ideal. I mean, how many people have read John Locke? If you want to know what your ideas are based on, and I'm not saying all of American or Republican ideas tie into John Locke, but I'm just saying,
but if life, liberty, and private property, those are key.
If you have an idea of what you believe, do you know why you believe it? Do you have an idea of what the background was to it? How did those ideas come into popular belief? Do you know what the background is? Have you read Montesquieu? Have you read Locke? Have you read, I mean, both sides of the equation? Who have you read and who have you not read? What do you really know?
David, this week, my family, we went to the movie Lincoln. And after we walked out, my 24-year-old daughter said, I need to get speeches by Lincoln, and I need to memorize some of them. And I brought up Washington as well. And, you know, go back and look at Jefferson. Go back and look at Adams. There are speeches that actually reveal the character of what it is that we say we believe. It's just worth going back and not necessarily trusting a movie to tell you what people said, but go back and read the actual written record.
There was a fascinating thing that occurred, you know, when we were putting together our Constitution, and these are guys that had read all of the Enlightenment thinkers, and they were fascinated with gears, and they were fascinated with levers, and they were fascinated with pendulums, and they were fascinated with balance, and they were fascinated with counterbalances, and the mechanics of government made sense to them because the conversation of the day was an Enlightenment conversation, not to the exclusion of God, as some would suggest, in sort of with the rise of science, but there was a fascination with the way things worked and their proper functioning.
There was a good and a bad way to build something, like a clock.
Absolutely. And what we see happening even now, and again, this is where on a relative basis, let's say the U.S. economy went into a tailspin. The U.S. economy goes into a tailspin, and that has direct ramifications for many other countries just south of the border, who does 80% of their business with the United States. In other words, their economy, 80% of their economy is tied to trade with their North American neighbors. That would be Mexico.
Yeah.
To the degree that we go into a tailspin, they get flogged financially, just like they did in 2008, far more than the U.S. economy was damaged, the Mexican economy was damaged. You see the same thing happening with the BRIC countries.
Right.
Capital flows from the West are diminishing. China is attempting to reorient. Other countries do benefit from the process of that occurring. China, India, Brazil, they're under new pressures as the reorientation and regearing is occurring in the West. We're dealing with our fiscal issues, or trying to. And I don't know that we're coming up with the perfect solutions or even good solutions at all, as we've been discussing earlier today. Yet just this week in China, the stock market there, the Shanghai Exchange, is now trading at 1/3 of the value of its peak numbers.
Right.
We topped at 6,000. Now it's below 2,000. And what does this portend? There are changes occurring. Changes here in the United States. Yes. Reason to be mildly neutral to negative. Yes, maybe even darkly negative, perhaps. The question is it better anywhere else? I would argue no. I would argue dramatically no, because in a global economy, to the degree that we sneeze, yes, the rest of the world catches a cold or simply dies of pneumonia. There's a major knock-on effect. Things change here. We don't get our house in order, and something happens. Not so nice. What we look at is not what happens in the next 12 months, or even 12 days, but really what's happening even over a grander cycle. Beyond this election period, 2 years, and ultimately the next White House, 4 years, we see tremendous potential just south of the border. Mexico is going to be a fascinating story to develop following a major, major decline. U.S. stock market declines, the U.S. economy is in decline over the next several years. Mexico, I think, will go through the ringer. But what's interesting is, Kevin, as we've seen changes in China, we've gone from the differential in wages between Mexico and China being greater than 400% to now being less than 30%.
So Mexico's a real competitor right now with China.
And by the time you factor in transport costs, it's cheaper to manufacture in Mexico than it is in China. Where are there opportunities? There's always opportunities. Is there a reason to check out intellectually, to check out as an investor, to check out as a citizen? Well, you may think there is, but I beg to differ.
Well, and David, you know, you have brought up so many times in the past, you talk about time frames not being 12 days, 12 months, 2 years, 4 years, what have you. We were talking about the Patriots, and we were talking about the guys who wrote the Constitution. These men were legacy generational thinkers, and I know you and your family has really focused on that. Let's don't see how we're going to make a change here in a short period of time or capture an opportunity in a short period of time. All of that's appropriate to a degree, but you can't focus on the short term all the time. And so from a legacy standpoint, the ideas that you're talking about, the things that we cover in this program, the people we interview, the ones who are looking further down the road, politically, economically, what have you, We have to have a generational mindset.
You know, it was The Economist this week that discussed the resurgence of the Commonwealth, that is the 54-member club of previous British colonies. And, you know, sort of, it's interesting because what they were suggesting is there a role in competition with the EU, this block of English-speaking common law aficionados. The English don't control it anymore, but they have sort of a subtle cultural influence, the residual impact, if you will, of formerly being colonized. And I just ask the question, again, as things change the world over, and as globalization, which has expanded now for many years, moves in sort of a deglobalization trend, where are your advantages? This is reminiscent of a book that's now over a decade old. The title of it was The Anglosphere Challenge. And it basically said that this network of English-speaking countries that can reference the rule of law as a way of practicing business and,
they have the
and
same
applying
background.
Justice,
yeah.
They have the same background. This is the future. This is the future. You can't find commonality. Globalization will not continue in a disparate, disassociated way where everyone is playing by a different set of rules. The folks who will do best are the folks who are playing by the same set of rules. And again, I think The Economist article actually concludes that no, the Commonwealth is not coming back together. But I would suggest this, as we move through the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, perhaps of financial and economic compression and opportunity on the other side, greater challenges will exist outside of the countries that have a history of the rule of law than those with it. In other words, if you are a practitioner of the rule of law, you will recover that much more quickly. Why? Because people understand what a contract is. How do you set up a business? This is how we've done it in the past. This is how we'll do it in the future. There is no wheel to be invented. It's something that was operational during the Industrial Revolution, post-Industrial Revolution, and beyond industrialization, this modern era of globalization. We see major changes afoot. And we're actually not downtrodden. We think this is a pretty exciting time to be alive in spite of the challenges. We have the ability to adapt.
Well, and you know, when you talk about the rule of law, I still can't help but go back and look at the original copies of the Magna Carta. You know, you go to the British Library and you can see them on display there. That really was one document that really helped form the spine of what you're talking about. And of course, it adapted and ultimately became our Constitution. And we've continued to go up from there. But, you know, Dave, we, through the years, have interviewed various candidates. We have not endorsed them, but we've interviewed them because these guys who are actually trying to make a difference in the political realm oftentimes have ideas that would work if they were employed. Now, Steve Forbes is someone that we've never had on the show before. You've talked with him. You've been at conferences with him. And so, you know, next week we're planning on bringing him on and having him share, you know, the ideas, taxes, like what we talked about today, redistribution. How does it work?
What is the future of America? From the vantage point of someone who's played in the political realm, who's been a candidate for president, who has successfully operated a business for decades, and is an influencer of thinkers, and who continues to draw attention to issues which are particularly relevant in our current context, whether that is fiscal issues, tax issues, currency issues, as he suggested in Forbes magazine just a few months ago, the reintroduction of the gold standard and why that is so important. We'll be discussing these things and many more with Steve Forbes next week.
Well, David, I'll be looking forward to that interview. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.